From the Rust Belt to the White House, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump got a lot of support from working-class voters in places like Monessen, Pennsylvania, a Rust Belt town hit so hard by globalization that the mayor describes it this way.
If ISIS was to come here, they would keep on going because they say somebody already bombed us.
Many there are celebrating Trump's win. Luis Mancheno is not. He's a gay immigration attorney in New York, worried about the future. But right now, he's drawing inspiration from the words to a song.
And I'll rise up. I'll rise like the day. I'll rise up. I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up, and I'll do it 1,000 times again. And that's what I'm planning to do.
We'll hear from both sides of the Trump divide ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being with us. An election, you know, it's like a basketball game. There's got to be a winner and a loser, and we're going to hear from both in the next few minutes. In Pennsylvania, some folks felt like they won big on Tuesday. The state was once reliably Democratic, but Trump carried it, thanks in large part to voters in western Pennsylvania, blue-collar areas that were once home to thriving steel mills. Those jobs are largely gone, a fact that many there blame on bad trade deals and globalization. One of the places affected is Monessen, a town of 7,500 just south of Pittsburgh. Trump visited there in June. Joining me now is Lou Mavrakis, the mayor of Monessen. Mayor Lou was on our program back in July. So what is the mood in Monessen this week, Mayor Lou, after Trump was elected?
Marco, you know, a lot of people, I guess, were in a state of shock, just like it is all over the country and all over the world. No one expected, I guess, to see this happen. And Trump visiting this area, he knew what he was doing. Oddly enough, the road to the White House came through Monessen. Seven precincts here in the city of Monessen, you have approximately 700 registered Republicans. With that, Trump got 1,221 votes. That's unheard of in the city of Monessen. Those votes, you're looking at several Democrats had crossed over and voted for Trump, just as I predicted.
So the shock is over a town like Monessen, an old bastion of the Democratic Party, where it went for the Republican. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. So when you say the road to the White House passed through Monessen, what angered people? Why did people go out, change party affiliation, and vote for Donald Trump this time?
Well, all you have to do is come here to Monessen and look at all the blight that's left behind whenever the steel industry leaves. When the steel industry leaves, you know, you go up and down this valley, the Allegheny River and the Ohio River. All the steel plants were in this area that made this country what it is. The very communities that built this country are the communities that are suffering the most. You know, I had 4 years of Read My Lips. I had 8 years of Clinton. I had 8 years of Bush Jr. I had 8 years of Obama. And what does our community look like? It looks like Beirut, or it looks like if ISIS was to come here, they would keep on going because they say somebody already bombed us. And that's the way all the communities look that had steel mills up and down the Mon Valley, up and down the Allegheny in Ohio.
Now, when you spoke with us a few months ago, Mayor Lou, you and a few others in your city there in Monessen said you knew Donald Trump could not bring back steel jobs, that essentially you knew Trump was making hollow promises. So square that for us. How come all these people in Monessen went out and voted for him?
Because it's very simple. He come here, he give him some hope. Stop and think about it. This is what I'm going to propose to Trump. You get your neckties made in China. You get your suits made in China. All right, come here to Monessen. Make your ties here. Make your suits here. There used to be two clothing factories in this city beside the steel industry that we have. There's plenty of room for us to have industry coming here. It doesn't necessarily have to be steel. Now, could you bring back steel to the way it was? No. In 1955, when I went to work, 8,000 jobs there. Now, with the same amount of steel being produced today, with modern technology and with the computer age, 400 would produce the same amount of steel. So what are we talking about? You don't have to have steel come back here, but you got to have some jobs come back here. Now, surely, you know, Trump talks about the expertise that he has in agreements. Well, fine. Get the Chinese to bring some of their factories over here. Make the suits. Make the ties. Make something here in this country.
What will the people of Monessen be feeling in 2020 if you don't see any new manufacturing there?
You know what you're going to find? You're going to find a one-termer and somebody else is going to be elected.
Lou Mavrakis, the mayor of Manassas, Pennsylvania, thanks very much.
You're welcome, my friend.
So some voters in Pennsylvania are feeling hopeful post-election, but others across the country don't feel that way, especially immigrants.
How many synonyms are there for the words fear, anxiety, rage?
That's KCRW reporter Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
It's all of those emotions. Every place I go to in LA's many immigrant-rich communities, there is a lot of concern about what's going to happen next in this country when it comes to them personally. I mean, this is not an abstract public policy issue when it comes to cracking down on immigration. It could very well affect their lives and their status to remain in this country. And they know it.
And I assume a lot of them heard his words on mass deportation during the campaign, and they take that pretty seriously?
They take it very seriously. I mean, they do not see this as, oh, he just said that because he was in campaign mode. They expect to see some sort of move made tossing them out of the country. Although at the same time, they say, listen, Americans, you have to understand what we do for this country each and every day. We are your nannies. We are your gardeners. We are your housekeepers. You know, that's particularly the case here in Los Angeles. Immigrant labor, undocumented and documented, is sewn into the life of the community. It's how this city functions each and every day.
You visited a day laborer center in LA and spoke with some guys there before they began their shift. What did they tell you?
Yeah, and this is the kind of place you go to when, you know, you have a big gardening project or drywall project at your house and you're looking to get, you know, two, three, four guys to help you. Usually they told me, you know, our conversations are about our families back home or our favorite soccer club. But like everyone else in this country, they're talking about the election and the effect of the election. And I talked to one gentleman there, Eugenio. He's been in this country illegally for 6 years, and this is what he told me. So what he's saying is he expects things to get harder for him and his fellow undocumented in this country, and he expects Donald Trump to make good on what he calls threats, Donald Trump's threats, which are tossing a lot of people out of the country, targeting the immigrant community once he's in the White House.
This notion, Saul, that if Trump's threats to deport the undocumented immigrants actually materializes, then there would be very few people, if any, to do all the blue-collar work that this country needs. How real is that scenario?
If you took that labor force out of the equation, I don't know how a lot of places in California would function. Of course, the argument on the other side is, you know, these people broke the law and they shouldn't be in this country. And we'll just have to figure out how to do without that labor. But we have to respect America's immigration laws first.
What are immigration advocates going to do now? Are they vowing to fight Trump's proposed actions or right now just calming fears?
They're turning their attention to what they can do on the local front and whether or not cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, which have had immigrant-friendly policies, whether they should focus their attention on that and in a sense, create kind of a fortresses where immigrants are more protected than they are on the national scene. There's also a lot of concern, Marco, here about what about the undocumented immigrant children? What happens to them? I talked to Angelica Salas. She's the executive director of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in Los Angeles. She was very emotional about the issue of immigrant children, in particular undocumented immigrant children, and this is what she told me.
There's a whole generation of children who feel that because Donald Trump got elected, that somehow they're less than. I want to tell them, no, you are not. You're just as American as every other single child. You're just as worthy. You're just as valuable.
Saul, if these people are undocumented and Trump signs an executive order to deport them, what could they do?
I think what they're going to try to do, Marco, is challenge this in the courts where they can. And they also promise to take to the streets. I mean, not to do anything violent or anything like that, but to let America know the undocumented have a voice when it comes to issues that are important to them, namely their safety and their ability to stay in this country and have as normal lives as possible.
KCRW reporter Saul Gonzalez speaking with us from Los Angeles. Many thanks, Saul.
Thank you, Marco.
One group of voters who helped propel Donald Trump to the White House, conservative Christians. During the course of the campaign, Trump sometimes spoke and behaved in ways that Christians might deem unchristian, and yet they still supported him. We wanted to check in with a Christian Trump supporter, so we called Dr. Sabi Kumar. He's a Republican state legislator in Tennessee. He was just reelected on Tuesday. And I started out by asking him how the election looked from his hometown.
The election looked very much pro-Trump from the very beginning, and certainly Donald Trump carried 72% of the voters in Robertson County, Tennessee. The big issues of concern were really the direction of the country. This is a conservative society with very solid conservative values, and the feeling definitely is that our country has moved so far to the left on social issues that the course needs to be corrected.
So what about you? Did you support him?
Yes, I do, with certain reservations. Certainly, some of the pronouncements of President-elect Trump were not along the lines that we would have liked to see.
I want to ask you, though, Donald Trump had a lot of support in his campaign from Christians, despite his kind of unchristian vulgarity. Help us understand why the Christian community really liked Trump.
That is the enigma of Donald Trump, because here is a man who's a Manhattan billionaire, and he is able to identify with blue-collar workers. Here is a man who's not church committed, and he's able to identify with evangelicals. Here is a man who did not serve in the military, and he's able to gather and identify with and gain respect or support from veterans. That is an enigma, and that is one thing that media failed to understand.
So how do you think he does it? How do you think he
because
kind of succeeds?
He supports their values. Evangelical Christians feel that role of faith in government has been set aside. Government has been eliminated. My constituents very strongly believe about prayer in school. Prayer has been taken out of schools. We open our legislature, and I believe the U.S. Congress, every session with a prayer. Why do we not allow that at schools? These constituents or my fellow citizens feel that prayer and God and biblical values on which this nation was founded have been taken out of the government. And Donald Trump tells them so, and he supports the effort to restore those values in the government.
Just one last question, Dr. Kumar. It sounds like what you're saying is that in some cases, Christians will cut some vulgar people slack if those vulgar people are politicians and they're willing to get the government out of their lives.
Those Christians were definitely offended by the vulgarity because they are people with solid conservative values. Yet, what is the alternative? The alternative is to totally eliminate religion and follow the path that Hillary Clinton offered. So it was, I guess the common phrase will be lesser of the two evils. It is not that the Christian said, oh, this vulgarity is okay because he will benefit me. No, they are not that selfish a group. The point was, yes, he's vulgar. Yes, I don't like it. I wrote a recent article I write in the local newspaper, and my first phrase was that if shaking of the head from side to side would count as exercise, we will be a very fit society. That is the response that I received from my citizens. Again, 72% of them voted for Donald Trump, but the response was, yes, I'm going to vote for him, but they will shake their head side to side because they were unhappy with some of his statements that you characterize as vulgarity. Yes, these Christians are not accepting of that. They're unhappy with that. But when they look at the alternative of Hillary Clinton, then they chose Donald Trump over that.
Dr. Sabi Kumar, a Republican state legislator in Tennessee who was reelected on Tuesday. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, France's Marine Le Pen rides the Trump and Brexit wave. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Donald Trump's victory has inspired a lot of people and politicians around the world. One of them is Marine Le Pen, the leader of the far-right Front National in France. After the result came through on Trump, Le Pen said she hopes the same kind of upset would happen in France next year. Le Pen is running for president there. Vivian Walt reports from Paris for Time magazine. So tell us about Marine Le Pen, Vivian, and her party. How do they resemble Donald Trump and his ideas?
Well, I think more than anyone, certainly in Europe, you have a leader kind of waiting in the wings who really is in some ways a mirror image of Donald Trump, a nativist, someone with fairly clear, very similar ideas, block the borders, stop immigration, and pull out of the EU, cut international alliances. So in very many ways, she sees a very direct connection between Trump's victory and her potential victory in the presidential elections in France, which are happening just 5 months from now.
So in France, across France, do you find a popular revulsion with the political establishment and political elites and globalization?
It's a very, very stark division, and in very many ways mirrors the kind of elites versus the populists. It's really remarkable how similar the situation is if you get out of the kind of cushy, you know, gilded cage that represents Paris and the Paris elite, and you go out into the hinterland, the heartland of France. You find very, very much what you might have found in Ohio or Michigan or Wisconsin. A lot of very angry, frustrated people who feel utterly alienated from the kind of body politic and the kind of powers of the country, and feel like they've been left behind very much. You've had an absolutely stagnant economy through many years, rising unemployment that they cannot seem to get under 10%, and a revulsion really at Hollande very much,
François
who seems
Hollande,
to represent this. Pardon, yes, President François Hollande.
So I gather that the European Union is really no more popular in France than it is in the UK, and we just saw the UK vote to leave the EU, the so-called Brexit. Is a Frexit in the works?
This has always been a centerpiece of Marine Le Pen's program, is to get France out of the EU. And in fact, within 24 hours of the Brexit vote, you had the National Front, Marine Le Pen's party, put up posters all over France which said, Brexit, and now it's France's turn, and two hands busting out of chains. Mm. So that's their image, and that's their message.
So if Marine Le Pen associates closely with Donald Trump, I'm guessing the first 100 days of Trump's administration could affect her election prospects.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the French are watching extremely closely what happens with Trump now. Of course, it's dominating every single newscast. The whole conversation on every single TV network is, how does Trump compare to Le Pen? Who's worse? What does this do to Le Pen's prospects? I mean, it really is the crucial question at the moment. There are a number of issues that Trump has made clear he wants to tackle within his first 100 days, which have a direct bearing on France, most notably to pull the U.S. out of the climate deal. And the climate deal was President Hollande's singular achievement of his last 5 years in office, and something which Marine Le Pen has been very much against, of course.
Time Magazine's Vivian Walt in Paris. Always good to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's kind of a predictable trope at this point. If Donald Trump was not your choice of president, you might be thinking, only half-jokingly, Canada. You're not alone, as Late Show host Stephen Colbert demonstrated last night.
Now, a lot of folks are very casually throwing around the idea of moving to Canada, you know? I know, Canada, the language of France with the culture of Minnesota. Beautiful country, you're welcome. But don't reach for your passport yet, because last night, as the election returns were coming in, the Canadian immigration website crashed.
That is, in fact, true. The Canadian government immigration website had a spike of about 100,000 people going onto the site, and it crashed. The site is back up and sputtering along now, but it's not as easy as packing up your things and just driving north. The World's Canada Desk, Andrea Crossan, joins me now in the studio. So what's the deal, Andrea? Why can't we just move?
Hey, Marco. So, yeah, it is, in fact, possible to move to Canada. But like it is here in the U.S., there are some hurdles to jump over to get there. Canada has committed to allowing 300,000 immigrants next year. So let me break down the numbers for you. What that means is that there are 40,000 spots that are for refugees, 80,000 for people if you are related to a Canadian. For the other people that they're going to allow in as immigrants, it's for skilled workers. So If you have a good job offer in Canada, then start packing your bags. If you don't, it could be a very, very long wait.
Wow. So what about marrying a Canadian? Could that speed things up?
It could put you on the list. It is going to still take a few months to do that. You could, in fact, get onto a dating app called Maple Match. It's matching Americans to Canadians, so you could just swipe north. Maple Match profiles have the option for listing your citizenship status and which citizenship you'd be interested in obtaining.
Wow, it sounds though like a path to Canadian citizenship for Americans is not that easy. On a serious note, how are Canadians viewing this week's election results here?
It is kind of a mixed bag north of the border. It's hard to imagine for Canadians that there's going to be the kind of bromance that there is currently between Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President Obama. However, Canada is still the U.S.'s largest trading partner, and that is underpinned by NAFTA. And as we know, Donald Trump has said over and over again during the campaign that this is the worst deal in history and that he would want to renegotiate or end the North American Free Trade Agreement. So today, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau actually announced that he would be willing to talk about renegotiating NAFTA if that is what Donald Trump wants to do.
But renegotiating NAFTA, tearing it all up, I mean, wouldn't that be a big blow to the Canadian economy? Who would win?
It would be a huge blow. Most industries, this would be devastating too. However, there is one exception. Donald Trump has talked about allowing the Keystone XL oil sands pipeline to proceed.
As for moving to Canada, sounds like any Americans who want to do that are pretty much stuck on this side of the border.
Yeah, you know what? We have managed a long and very healthy relationship between Canada and the U.S., but it also means that we stay on our side of the tracks, you stay on yours. And for Canadians, we never want to be seen as your consolation nation. You know, you can't just come north if things aren't working out down here.
Yeah. When it comes to French fries, though, I got to get up to Quebec for the poutine. Andrea Cross and our One Woman Canada desk, thank you for the guidance.
Thank you.
News headlines are up next, right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. What will President Trump's first 100 days be like? His advisors say his campaign rhetoric should give you a good idea.
What they'll tell you is it's a mistake to assume that he's doing this for political theater. He means what he's going to say, and he has ways of getting around the opposition.
Trump's agenda, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The transition is underway. President-elect Donald Trump flew to Washington today to meet with Barack Obama at the White House. Mr. Trump said they discussed a lot of different situations, some wonderful and some difficulties. And Mr. Obama pledged to do everything to help the president-elect succeed. So what might President Trump do and not do when he gets into the Oval Office? Evan Osnos writes for The New Yorker magazine.
There have been studies over the years of how often do candidates keep their promises once they get to the White House. And it turns out actually that campaigns offer a surprisingly and very good preview of what presidents do. They tend to keep more than two-thirds of the things that they campaign on. And that's not because they necessarily expected to do all of the things they said, but once they get into office, if they don't do the things that they said they were going to do, they immediately begin to lose credibility with their supporters. And therefore, there's a sort of internal pressure that takes hold between the Congress and the White House and the public that almost compels them to do the things that they ran on. If people are imagining, either for better or worse, that Donald Trump is not going to do what he says, I think that the history of the presidency doesn't support that.
Yeah, but that political science is based on fairly mainstream candidates and their promises. Donald Trump has made some pretty extreme promises, including, deporting up to 12 million undocumented immigrants. I mean, doesn't that change the science a little bit on this one, potentially?
He's certainly an unusual candidate, but I think if you talk to his advisors, as I've been doing over the last few months, what they'll tell you is it's a mistake to assume that he's doing this for political theater. He means what he's going to say, and he has ways of getting around the opposition to his ideas. Take, for example, the plan that he has at times promoted and then abandoned and then sort of readopted to to ban Muslims from entering the United States. And Roger Stone, who's been an advisor to Donald Trump off and on for 40 years, told me if the courts don't allow him to ban Muslims from coming to the United States, then he'll ban people by geographical origin from Egypt, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, and so on. Their belief is that even if he has made pledges that we think are radical, he has ways of being able to use the powers of government to be able to achieve them.
Yeah. What about executive orders on January 20th after he's sworn in? What do we know about what he wants to do?
The campaign has what it calls a first day project, which is that they are planning as many as 25 executive actions on the first day or within the first few days. That begins with one of the first things they plan to do is to withdraw the United States from the Paris climate deal, or on a more technical level, simply put out a notice that they're not going to enforce the provisions of it. They can and plan to suspend the Syrian refugee resettlement program. They may direct the Commerce Department to bring trade cases against China. They will also begin to expand the pace and intensity of deportation proceedings. They have said that they would do this, and this is going to be one of the things that, as Donald Trump says, he will do in, quote, the first hour in office, unquote. I should say, you know, people who have been through transition say that the idea of doing 25 things on the first day is not realistic, that the Obama administration, for instance, did about 8 things within the first 10 days. But their goal here is explicit. They're going to try to undo as much of the Obama administration's legacy as they can.
Are we talking Donald Trump's signature as well as action? I mean, how much can he do as an executive action that will actually materialize?
He can do a lot. You know, most people, when we think about the power of the presidency, talk about checks and balances. But over the last 100 years, the power of the presidency has expanded considerably. Partly this was the nature of the Cold War that meant that there was more power being invested in the White House because they had to be able to make decisions more rapidly. And the reality is that Donald Trump, with his signature today, could, for instance, withdraw the United States from the World Trade Organization. He doesn't need Congress's approval. He could, with his signature or even just with his declaration, he could declare the United States will renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal. So for us to assume that the Congress here or the courts have the ability to stop a president from doing things, that's wrong. What the Congress and the courts have the ability to do is to try to check a president or to challenge a president after he has done those things. But as a constitutional scholar will tell you, the president's major advantage is that he has the first move. Once he does something, it's a fait accompli, and it's up to the other branches to try to undo it.
What is the one area where we just have no clue about what Donald Trump will do or how he will act, or maybe an area where you think we're going to have a big surprise?
Yeah, the thing we don't know now is how he's going to respond to a shock. And there are going to be shocks. There's going to be the moment, for instance, when a Chinese plane and an American plane collide over the South China Sea. It happened in 2001, and it became a defining moment in the early moments of the George W. Bush presidency. But we simply do not know how Donald Trump will respond to a shock, to a moment when he doesn't have enough information, to a moment when he has to make a decision on the fly. And frankly, that may have more sweeping consequences for American lives than the things that he plans at the outset.
Evan Osnos with The New Yorker. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
My next guest, Luis Mancheno, fled his home country in 2008. As a gay man, life for Mancheno was not easy in Ecuador, so he moved to the U.S. and applied for refugee status. He got to stay, and in June of this year, he became an American citizen. Today, he's an attorney in New York. And this past Tuesday, he voted for the first time in an American election. Luis joins me again from New York. Luis, we had you on the show last week, and one thing you said that really stuck with us was that when you were going to vote on Tuesday as an American, you'd be saying loud and clear, this is also my country. So today, does this feel like your country?
You know, it's interesting because on Tuesday, it definitely felt like that. I felt that when I was voting, I was saying it loud and clear, this is my country. I also get to have a say in what the future of my country should look like. Today, I'm not sure. I'm not sure of what the future holds for me, and I'm not sure what the future holds for my community. And to be honest, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of what it is to come.
What would give you hope at this point?
You know, I I wrote a letter to a Trump supporter that I know of yesterday. And I want to believe that there are Trump supporters out there who did not vote because of his racist, homophobic, or anti-immigrant rhetoric, but they simply voted because they want to change, they wanted jobs, they wanted to get their lives and their families' lives better, and that they will stand up with me when President Trump or his allies will decide to strike against my community, the immigrant community, or the LGBT community. And I just hope that they will stand up for me then, and that the American people will be there for me when I need them the most.
And you've got several different communities to kind of be mindful of. I mean, it's not just you, but it's also your clients, because you're an immigration attorney. How do you think the Trump presidency will affect your clients?
You know, more than anything, even though I feel like this has affected me personally because I am an immigrant, I am gay and I'm Latino. I mean, I can check so many boxes. I think that today when I woke up, I said I need to be strong for my clients. I need to be strong because they are the ones who are going to be directly affected. As you mentioned, I'm a citizen now. So at least under the law and the Constitution, I should be protected against deportation. Although who knows, sometimes, you know, thoughts cross my mind about like whether, you know, like anything terrible could happen to me. But to my clients, I will protect them. I will fight in court tooth and nail to make sure that they won't get deported, to make sure that they get to stay in the place that they have called home for so many years. They have their lives here, their families here, and I will do my best to stand up for them and to say this is also their country too.
I got to say, Luis, I can even hear the change in your voice from the last time we spoke last week. Since Trump was elected, have you even changed your behavior in any way?
You know, I live in New York City, and one of the things that I said last time is that I felt that people had it for granted to not be noticed. And today when was walking down the street, I felt noticed again. I felt noticed by many people of color, white people. I just know that I am visible once again, and that's not great.
Visible as an immigrant as opposed to kind of seeking that anonymity
Visible as an immigrant, visible as a Latino, visible as a gay man. All I hope for is that, you know, my visibility doesn't bring danger and harm to my life.
So what now, Luis? And how are you going to move forward? And does being in a blue city, in a blue state, provide any consolation?
Definitely. I feel like I am somehow protected from this rhetoric, but I not only care about myself, I care about that gay kid right now who is deciding to come out in Arkansas, or I care about that immigrant family in Tennessee who is afraid right now because they believe that there's going to be a deportation force coming and knocking on their door anytime now. But look, I have been through so much in my life. And all I can tell you is that I will be strong for my community. I was listening to Andrea Day this morning, her song Rise Up. And I think that there's nothing that sums up better the way that I feel right now and how I'm planning to have my life from now on. And the song says, in the part that I think that I like the best says, and I'll rise up, I'll rise like the day, I'll rise up, I'll rise unafraid, I'll rise up, and I'll do it 1,000 times again. And that's what I'm planning to do.
Luis Mancheno is an immigration attorney in New York. You can read his letter to a Trump supporter at PRI.org. Luis, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Malcolm.
President-elect Trump has already gotten a jump on foreign policy matters. He called up South Korean President Park Geun-hye. She said Trump called to pledge his commitment to protect her country against North Korean threats. Part of America's defense includes the installation of a new missile system called THAAD. That's short for Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, and it's designed to shoot North Korean rockets out of the air. But some South Koreans are worried about the potential health effects in the area around the proposed missile site. Here's Jason Strother with our story.
In Gimcheon City, it's pretty easy to tell who's against the new U.S. missile system. Red banners saying no to THAAD hang off terraces on apartment towers all over this part of town. From here, it's about 4 miles to the golf course that will be converted into a missile battery sometime next year. You also see the anti-THAAD signs in front of local businesses, too, like this cell phone shop. Lim Sanhuan is the owner.
80 to 90% of the people here in Gimcheon are against the missiles. We don't know what the health impact is going to be. I have a 4-year-old son, and I don't want him to be harmed.
Lim says he's worried about the emissions from the missile system's radar. Nationwide polls show the majority of South Koreans favor the missile deployment. But it's a divisive issue here. When I grab a ride with taxi driver Shin Sang-won, he tells me that ever since the South Korean government selected the area to host the missile system in September, arguments keep breaking out.
Hey, I'm just the driver. I don't want any problems. I only talk about it unless they bring it up. I'll tell them I support that if they ask. I've never had an argument with a passenger, but a couple I picked up got into a fight in my car over the missiles.
The voices get louder as you travel closer to the planned missile site. 59-year-old melon farmer Lee Jung-hee wears a red ribbon that says "totally against THAAD" around his brown wide-brimmed hat. He's getting ready to lead a protest outside a community center just down the road from the golf course. He says the U.S. government is not telling locals how dangerous the missile system could be to their health. I really think this missile deployment is going to make South Koreans angry at the American military here, Lee says. Remember when protesters burnt down an American cultural center? I won't be surprised if something like that happens again. That incident happened in 1982 during a time of strong resentment against the U.S. for its support of South Korea's dictatorship. Violent protests also erupted outside U.S. bases in the early 2000s following a traffic accident involving an American convoy that killed 2 Korean schoolgirls. But Kim Won-myung says that's just one side of things. He's a monk at a nearby Buddhist temple. He brings me inside a small meditation room and lights candles and incense before bowing to a shrine. Kim says locals in this very conservative part of Korea still have positive feelings about American forces stationed in their country. I don't think anyone here is really angry at the U.S. because of the missiles, the monk says. America is our ally. But he adds that he does think Washington is pressuring Korea to deploy the THAAD system. It's hard for Korea to say no because we are the weaker partner in this relationship, he says. The U.S. and South Korean militaries have tried to calm local concerns. They maintain that the THAAD system radar emissions meet safety standards and there won't be any adverse effect on the surrounding communities. But that hasn't satisfied opponents. Back at the community center's parking lot, around 100, mostly elderly residents, are sitting on plastic stools, listening to protest leader Lee Jung-hee speak. Before the rally, he told me how they'll stop the missiles. He says if these missiles are brought here, we are going to physically block the road to the base. And if there are any fights between protesters and the authorities, the U.S. is to blame. For The World, Jason Strother, Songju County, South Korea.
We know feelings are running high after the election. Half the nation that voted is celebrating Donald Trump's triumph, while the other half is not. And kids who can't vote are confused. So are many parents and teachers. I mean, how do we talk to our children about a nation that is so divided? We're going to spend time now in one preschool where teachers and students are wrestling with a Trump victory. From Los Angeles, here's Deepa Fernandez.
In some ways, it was preschool as usual, the day after Donald Trump was elected President of the United States. Yet as toddlers at World City Center Preschool in the West Adams area of Los Angeles finish music class and are washing their hands for snack time, the mood is grim.
The thing that you can't lie about is the fact that everybody is devastated this morning, that we're all sad.
Rebecca Bernard founded the Dual Language Immersion Preschool. And as preschools go, it has a truly diverse mix of kids.
Yesterday, we were so excited to go over to the polling place and really encourage a spirit of, you know, political engagement with them and teaching them that they are a part of this democracy and that their vote counts and that it matters. And then to be, you know, so devastated the next day, it's I can assume that energetically it's just confusing, you know? Well, yeah, you guys were so excited yesterday, and today everybody's crying. What's happening? Even my parents are crying. Why?
And sure enough, in the three-year-old room, the election results come up.
I went voting yesterday, and then I got a sticker from the mayor.
She's so proud of her I voted sticker. She's looking right at her teacher, Cynthia Gonzalez, whose face didn't share the three-year-old's excitement. Gonzalez is somber, and she tells her she's sad.
Estamos tristes. Tal vez los padres estaban un poquito tristes.
Because Jack wasn't happy. My mom wasn't happy.
If you guys see us a little sad, if you guys see the teachers a little sad and a little bit teary and crying. Because we're a little sad. Estamos un poco tristes, okay? Electaron un presidente. We elected a president we don't like. No nos queremos.
The children look wide-eyed at their teacher. One little boy rubs her leg empathetically. What Gonzalez said came straight from the heart, says director Rebecca Bernard.
The teachers are Latinas, and they're proud of their cultural heritage, and they're also proud and grateful to be in this country. And the feeling of what they're feeling, one of the things that we teach the preschoolers is that you can't negate what you're feeling, that you have to honor your feelings.
So the day after the election was a day of explaining feelings, owning them, being okay with them.
Sí, es cuando no queremos que alguien gane, when we don't want someone to win. Like Amar Prakash, you love the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you sad when the Dodgers don't win?
Chop, it's your holy fireball.
Bernard said when the results began to indicate a Trump victory, she searched around for how to talk with her kids about it, but didn't find much.
The thing that I read for the 3 to 4 year olds was, wow, they elected a president. And, you know, some of us feel like that was a bad choice. It's a silly country that we live in sometimes. And it just felt inauthentic to me.
So instead, they just let the feelings roll.
Felices o tristes o enojados. ¿Quién puede hacer una cara enojado?
Who can make an angry face?
Una cara feliz.
Who can make a happy face?
Y todos estos sentimientos.
All these feelings are okay, Bernard tells the three-year-olds. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Los Angeles.
Older kids also have questions about the results of this election. Allie Michael is a teacher educator based in Philadelphia. She says no matter your political stripe, it's important to explain to your kids and teens that democracies are designed to ensure that no one person has too much power.
My daughter, who's 6 years old, woke up. I told her that Trump won, and she asked if her Muslim friend was going to be in school that day, or was she already gone? Mm. I mean, they are nervous about the things that he has said about people of color, about disabled people, about our gay and lesbian family and friends, and about Muslims. And so I think we need to tell them that we'll protect them, and we also need to tell them that we will honor the outcome of the election, but that we are going to stand up with our friends and neighbors of all different identities, and we're going to protect them. We're going to speak out for their rights, and we're not going to let them be taken away.
So what about the kids of Trump supporters? Because those supporters have been demonized throughout the campaign. Now their candidate has won. What should their parents be telling them?
You know, I think we all need to tell kids that in a presidential election, some people win and some people lose, and this is a democracy, and we all work together to make the democracy work. I would like for parents of Trump supporters to tell them the reasons why they voted for Trump and to distinguish between whatever it is they are concerned about in terms of the economy or Washington insiders or whatever that is from the bigotry, and to say, we support him because we don't want a Washington insider, but we are not racist. We believe that people should be equal. We don't believe in taking away people's rights or deporting people. It depends on what they believe. But I think that if you're a Trump supporter because of the economy, then it's on you to really differentiate yourself from some of the bigotry that he's been espousing.
I've been seeing kind of two trends opening up with people who voted, let's say, against Trump, those who say it's time to revolt and say he's not our president, and those who say, no, we need to heal the divide and listen to the other side. When you have children who say he's not my president, how do you still support their desire to express themselves freely without leading to deeper divisions and misunderstanding?
He is our president right now. He is the president-elect, and we have to figure out how to work with the democratic process to express our views and our dissent. People said that when Obama was elected, too, he's not my president. That's not the case. We rise and fall together as a country. But that doesn't mean that you can't have dissent. If you have students who don't like what the American flag stands for right now and they want to kneel, for example, during the Pledge of Allegiance, that should be an option, and we could have them write about why they don't feel that they can stand. And then you might have kids in your school who are offended by that, who are offended by people kneeling, and they should have a chance to also write their opinion, and you can hang those up. And it creates space for dialogue about these different views. I mean, to have children who are that deeply invested in the meaning of their standing or kneeling and the words that they say is really what we want in a democracy. We have people really taking this seriously right now, which I think is very powerful, and we need to really harness that in a way that says your voice and your actions do matter, and we have to be able to talk about why we believe the things that we believe.
Ali Michael, thanks so much for your thoughts.
Thanks, Marco.
Yeah, it's not easy to talk about. We will all be learning along the way. Ali Michael there, she's a writer and director at the Center for the Study of Race and Equity in Education. That's The World on this Thursday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Hope you'll make it here again tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.